Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss the psychology of belief with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Mindy.
Good morning, Mindy.
A new report led by Mass General shows young adults aged 18 to 24 throughout the country are experiencing higher rates of major depressive symptoms. The new study was a follow-up to one released in May, which saw higher instances of depression spanned across all ages. Depression was up 27% compared to the past. The younger individuals are experiencing depression, anxiety, and for some, thoughts of suicide. Just one in five young adults said they had not experienced a major change. Not sure this is really a surprise to anyone, considering we're in a pandemic, which is limiting our social connections, which are really critical to overall health, right? I mean, this is a having this the social connections is huge.
Absolutely, you know, we are a social animal, and we've evolved into the humans that we are because of being such a social animal and having a brain power enough to communicate ideas and concepts and problem-solving kind of things. So we start life with life depending or being alive depending entirely on a social interaction, namely infant with mother. And we stay that way pretty much because our social interactions regulate our body stability, all sorts of things in our body, homeostasis of chemical balance situations, systems, everything, so that you deprive somebody of social interaction, they feel it in their body, and their body suffers. You know, they feel it in a negative way. Their body suffers. That's why solitary confinement is torture. That's really what it is, and that's why there's some moral objection to it. But the point is, though, that we exist because of our connections and through our connections with other people, and that's the human condition.
What I've seen in my own practice, which is a lot of adolescents and kids as well as adults, is that over this last month or two, I've really seen a lot of people coming unglued. It seems almost as if it's really been a progressive deterioration in people's ability to hang on and to be patient and to look forward to a better day and to believe with optimism that, you know, the end is in sight and so on and so forth. And actually, even as we do have evidence of the end being in sight with all the great news about the vaccinations and their high, their high success rate in the clinical trials, the reality for teenagers and for college students, of whom I have many, who are working remotely from home, is that they are finding it more and more difficult to concentrate, more and more difficult to have the, you know, to sort of focus, to have the energy, even to exercise, to get outside. And of course, we know, we had a great talk last month with Dr. Jensen about kids' frontal lobes. And so it's really a battle for them and for their parents to find ways to prevent them from doing foolish things out of this sort of really desperate need for connectedness.
Right.
Well, you think of the developmental needs of teens and then young adults, and what they're doing is creating their sense of identity and where they fit in. They're experimenting with new thoughts and ideas, challenging the belief system of their parents, perhaps, and to not have any way to measure that, which is what they do when they go to school, you know, the teenagers, and measuring where they fit in, the feedback, what's their status like. All these developmental tasks are not being, they're not able to be implemented. And therefore, it feels very bleak. And I would think college students with the whole idea of not only the socialization and the interaction, but the idea that they're moving towards something very, professional or tangible in their education, with really no, we've lost the goals. We've lost the way to measure things. So I think it's really very hard when you think of these developmental tasks being completely interfered with.
Yeah, it's like jumping off a a cliff into water that you don't know how to swim. You haven't had the interactive practice to be in society and develop and have a sense of identity. So that's why we see this jump in statistics for depression. I'm part of a private practice group in the Lower Cape here, and the therapists, the primarily therapists that are members, don't have time anymore to accept new patients. I hear that from patients too. It's just hard to get an appointment with some kind of behavioral health provider, whatever the discipline is, the social work, or psychiatry or nurse practitioner, whatever. It's because there is a just such a need nowadays across the country. I also see it. I review some files for disability determination, and one of the criteria that the insurance company uses if somebody's really disabled is they need to be seen by a specialist within a week or two or 2 weeks. And if they delay, then they're faking it. You know what I mean? Yeah. The rule is, it's a rule now that it takes a month, 6 weeks before you can get in for a first visit somewhere. You know, this is just another dimension of how we're suffering as a result of this pandemic.
Yeah. How do you think our belief system, what is the role our belief system has in this? You know, on the one hand, we know that this pandemic is temporary, but we also are not sure what life will look like after the pandemic, right? So how does our belief system play into all of this?
Well, we use our belief system to navigate the world. That's what our belief system is all about. How do you navigate the world? And it consists of things that you've learned, primarily what you've been taught by adults as you've been growing up, that form the basis of belief systems, because you learn certain concepts from your culture. And when you're growing up, your culture is your parents. So we learn certain beliefs that are, first of all, beliefs are convictions that something is true. It's not a thought-out experimental proof. It's just a belief. You believe that it's true, you have a feeling that it's true. That's what makes it different from just thinking, because there's a feeling that goes with it that's rooted in your body, actually, an emotion that is rooted in your body, where that's where emotions come from, actually, because there's a way of guiding the person, the organism, in the world that's going to be safe and assure survival. So it's a basic survival mechanism that we're talking about. And one of its expressions is beliefs, because beliefs are how we, like I said, look at the world. They're shortcuts, actually, for coming to a conclusion about something. Shortcuts for, because our brain works on pattern recognition. So a belief, if you have a belief about something, you already have a category to put new information in, and you know what to expect. And knowing what to expect provides a sense of security, a sense of well-being. And not knowing what to expect is just the opposite. And that's what is jarring us, because the belief systems we have don't serve us too well with a worldwide pandemic. Other than you can believe in science is going to work, and there's good news about that lately. We're faced with our beliefs about the world being safe, secure, challenged. That's our task, and one of the consequences is just what we've been talking about, is the high cost to our psyches. And it's because the world is not conforming to what we want it to do, or believe it to do. We believe that we can, you know, wake up and be well tomorrow, don't have a fever and can't breathe. But that's not, we can't be assured of that now. And we see people dropping all over because of that lack of assurance.
One part of this that I think is really, it's depressing and it's stunning and it's bizarre, are the protests that we've seen today in the news. It's Berlin. A couple of days ago, it was in Michigan. People on the streets prepared to march and protest the restrictions that are now being imposed by the, you know, increasing pandemic. And people are angry, and people are talking about how their constitutional rights are being infringed upon by governors or heads of state who are saying, you know, you have to stay home, or you can't go to the restaurant, or, you know, whatever. I find it confusing and puzzling. I don't understand why people feel like it's somehow their human, God-given right to do things which clearly the scientists are saying is only making things worse. I just I wonder if other people in the panel, or maybe someone who would like to call in, can help me understand and make sense of this.
Well, it's a different belief system. Sorry, Andy, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was going to say, if we pull aside the behavior and look at what's behind it, they have a belief system that has been encouraged on social media that, well, it's a hoax, or they're going to take away your freedom to, you know, I'm not going to have the government tell me. So there's a belief system that's as enforced and intact as our belief that, oh my God, put a mask on, distance, let's save each other.
Right.
And I think that's what's really perplexing for all of us, is because of the way social media is working now, what we see is everything that reinforces our own belief system. There's a whole other world out there, apparently, which I don't delve into, but I'm aware of it,
yep,
that has a construction, and it can go back as far as biblical and rights, and it's all connected, but it's baffling.
Yeah, but, well, it's baffling to you, but it's not to them, because they see what reinforces their belief, and they're reacting to that, and that's where they're holding on to their beliefs that really value authority and value their own authority, I guess, is what they're pushing for. That gives them a sense of safety if they feel they're somehow in control. This pandemic is a situation where nobody is in control. But swallowing that for some people is very, very difficult, because it shakes their very sense of security and their belief system they're vulnerable, and they got to be careful. They got to make some sacrifices to survive, really, and help society survive. That's very hard for a certain people that are oriented toward getting ahead rather than getting along. They're oriented to being in charge, being authority, following an authority. I think that's why Trump is so appealing to them. So that provides them with security, whereas others, or at least the majority, the people that believe in science and value science, will allow their behavior to be guided by the conclusions drawn from that field, as opposed to some kind of idea or a person that they want to hold up as an authority and look up as a protector. In other words, their belief system is stronger. Their emotional attachment to those beliefs is stronger than logic.
866-999-4626 is our number if listeners would like to chime in. You have some thoughts, comments, or questions for us. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of belief with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So let's talk about what happens when a belief that you hold dear is shattered. And spoiler alert, if you have young children, turn down the volume for a minute, because one of the things I'm thinking about, you know, I remember when I found out about the Easter Bunny. My cousin pulled me into the closet and said, "The Easter Bunny does not exist. It's your parents." And I was like, "What?" She goes, "So is Santa Claus. So is the Tooth Fairy." I mean, I got it all right there. And I walked out of that closet going, "How could this be true?" Devastated.
Yeah.
So, you know, belief systems, when they get shattered, it's a big deal, right?
Absolutely, because they're really rooted in emotion. There's a very strong emotion driver that forms beliefs. And if you took emotion out of the equation, you wouldn't have a belief. It's a gut feeling that goes with a belief, so that your sense of security, that your whole world was shattered because Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, Tooth Fairy, all those characters really had you in mind as being very special. Your cousin threw you into the deep end on that one.
Sure did.
Well, it upsets relationships. I'm thinking of there's a group on Facebook that noticed called Suburban Housewives Against Trump, which was a political gathering group. And the fascinating thing about that group was it was like 200,000 strong, and they were women of all backgrounds. They weren't necessarily housewives. But they joined up, and there were many who had been lifelong Republicans. And being a lifelong Republican, and then the cognitive dissonance that they felt, and they joined up and were voting or planning to vote for the Democratic candidate. They then, subsequently, a lot of them wrote, "I have lost friends. My husband's not speaking to me. Mm-hmm. My signs in front of my lawn have been all, I'm in a little town in Ohio that I stand out. I have lost so much." And I think that's the a big problem with when beliefs are shattered, or when we change beliefs because we can't live with the dissidents.
Right.
Another example would be when immigrant families, when the families from Pakistan come over with all the traditional beliefs and religions and customs, and the young people, their children, try and fit into a culture that does not support that, religious or educational or social mores, and the conflict that happens in so many immigrant families because the parents are saying this is who you are, and the kids are saying this is who I want to be because I got to fit in here. So right. I think that there's lots of different ways that our beliefs can be challenged and shattered, and it's always a fearful cost because our identity is wrapped up whether we decide to change and move over to another belief system, or there is a great loss.
That's right.
And
Yeah, you're talking about the social aspect of beliefs and the social forces, and really certain beliefs define your tribe, define you as a member of your tribe. And if you, like these suburban former Republicans, if you swerve from that, you're extruded because you're a threat to the group now. You're no longer an insider. They have to extrude you in order to keep their own cognitive dissonance in check. They'll just write you off as somebody who lost their mind or whatever. Yeah. They'll have an explanation for why you shifted, they'll stick to that as if it's true. It has to be true because it has to be true for them to preserve their tribe, their belief. Yeah. So beliefs and social cohesiveness go hand in hand. That's why beliefs are so central to our everyday life and everyday identity. And they're being challenged now this pandemic, and also certainly challenged by the extreme that our present president goes to reinforce his belief. His belief is in himself only, but people have signed on to that. 70-some million have. It's a challenge, and we don't have civil warfare here. We have a tribal warfare in a way in the country.
Let's talk to Sharon, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Sharon.
Yes, good morning, Mindy, and thank you for having such knowledgeable guests on the program this morning. I just wanted to say, as a mother of a now 23-year-old young woman, I wanted to concur with a previous comment of one of your guests in two ways, and that is to say they were baffled by the reaction, current reaction in this country and abroad, of people resisting science, etc. And I just wanted to say a comment that I feel this can be attested in this country to the total politicization of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And that will lead to my next input. I'd like to get some feedback. And that is that there has been, for many years, particularly the last 5 years, pre-pandemic, a total social media assassination of our young people's minds that has been, in very many ways, unbridled. And my daughter was in great need of not just a therapist, but at least a nurse practitioner who can prescribe, or psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, and again I tried 2 years ago with some success. And the shortage nationwide of these people, but in particular on Cape Cod, it took me 7 months, mm-hmm. 7 months for her to get an appointment beyond just, you know, the primary care physician saying, oh, she needs to see someone.
Yep.
Because their practices either don't exist because there's such a shortage, or they're closed.
Yeah.
On Cape the way up to the South Plymouth.
Sharon, it's a big problem, and we've talked about this before. This isn't just on the Cape. This is nationwide. Especially for young people, it's tough to find. And we've had some thoughts on why that is. Maybe not as many people going into psychiatry. Who wants to chime in on that? Why we have such a shortage of mental health care providers?
Well, it's multi. One is, at least in terms of medicine as a specialty, or, you know, psychiatry as a specialty of medicine, is that psychiatry is not a popular one. It doesn't have procedures, and it doesn't have the big dollars, the big incomes, as other specialties do. So that's been hypothesized, that and primary care, actually, or the lower paid of a medical specialty. So money, unfortunately, does play a part in the shortage. I think when I first trained back in the 70s or 60s and 70s, psychiatry was really a stepchild of medicine, and there was some question about it being extruded, more or less. And in a way, what I was taught about psychiatry was not very much connected to medicine or the body. It was psychoanalytic theory, really. We are much more biologically rooted and oriented. So at least we're coming at the problem from a rational standpoint and not a made-up story kind of standpoint. The field is better, but we don't have enough people in the field, period. I think it's especially, we were talking about money, especially social workers are vastly underpaid. They're like teachers in a way. You have to have a dedication to the field and kind of be willing to take something of a vow of poverty to enter it. From my personal standpoint, you won't have a more rewarding field than this one, where you really get to know people and get connect with them and really see the power of your own self on them, because that's what we study and that's what we use to influence. It's a really rewarding field. So I guess I'm making a pitch for any young people out there.
It should be noted that there has been actually a huge increase in the presence of psychiatric nurse practitioners,
yes.
Not only on the Cape, but also through the South Coast and South Shore areas. You know, I don't know exactly when the psychiatric nurse practitioner field was born in Massachusetts, but Mark and I can certainly remember not that long ago that there was no such thing
as
a psychiatric nurse practitioner. Now in the greater New Bedford area and in the Plymouth area and on the Cape as well, I think it's actually much easier, if you just count numbers, to find psychiatric nurse practitioners than it is to find psychiatrists. But as Mark says, psychiatry has always been sort of viewed by many of so-called peers of other physicians as kind of like, are you people really doctors anyway? And that has been changing, by the way. The last couple of years, the number of medical students who have been requesting psychiatry residencies has actually increased as a percentage of graduating medical students. But it would take, I don't know if that's just a blip or if that's actually a trend that will persist, but it would take a very long time to make up for the age-old lack of adequate numbers of prescribers. And I think that's much more likely to come in the form of nurse practitioners than it is psychiatrists anyway.
As a practical piece of advice, I would advise somebody seeking treatment is when they get a no from a particular practitioner, keep them on the phone and ask them who they would recommend, who they would send their family member to. Be aggressive about it. You have a better chance, certainly, of having some success. Don't just take no for an answer, in other words.
Yeah, Sharon, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So some things we believe just because we believe. There's no logic to it. Buying that lottery ticket because you believe that you have the chance of winning the big bucks, you're more likely to get hit by lightning. But despite the odds, does our brain take in the facts, long odds, that someone will win. So that little fact that somebody's going to win, even though the odds are against me, does that reinforce the belief that I have this chance? What's happening in our brains?
Well, we're using a belief system that's a shortcut that makes us feel good. There is some neuroscience research on what's called the feeling of knowing, which it might sound a little bit contradictory, because knowing seems to be a cognitive thing, and feeling is an emotional thing. But there really is something very much real to this. I'll give you an example. Everybody has an example of feeling and knowing. The aha moment, when you have something on the tip of your tongue, you just know you know it. You know that actor in X, Y, and Z film, but you can't pick the name out. You have that feeling that you know, and you feel very gratified if it comes to you when you want it to. A lot of times, most of the time it doesn't, but if it comes to you, then you're gratified, you feel pleasure. That's what reinforces a feeling of knowing. And this is a basic emotion that comes from evolution again, because it promotes wise and usually survival advantageous decisions and behaviors. The feeling of knowing. If you want, I can demonstrate it with that short paragraph. It's okay if I read that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to read a short paragraph, and I'm going to urge the listeners just to watch your inner reactions to this, because I'm going to read this paragraph, and I'm going to ask you, or you're going to be asked, what is this paragraph about? It's what does it involve? So just kind of watch how your thought processes go, and we'll demonstrate something here. Here it is. A newspaper is better than a magazine. A seashore is a better place than the street. At first, it is better to run than to walk. You may have to try several times. It takes some skill, but it's easy to learn. Even young children can learn it. Once successful, complications are minimal. Birds seldom get too close. Rain, however, soaks in very fast. Too many people doing the same thing can cause problems. One needs lots of room. If there are no complications, it can be peaceful. A rock will serve as an anchor. If things break loose from it, however, you will not get a second chance. Okay, now what do you think of that was concerning? What was that all about?
We read the paragraph, so we know the answer.
You know the answer. I've done this before. But now if I say the word kite, K-I-T-E, what do you feel? What do you sense? All those things fit with the concept of flying a kite, okay? That's the feeling of knowing that you just experienced. You now know something that was confusing and basically didn't make any sense. It was kind of nonsense words. Now you know it, and you get a burst of something of a little bit of a joyful feeling. Oh, yeah, now I understand. Now I know what you mean. Everything fits with that. That's the feeling of knowing. So beliefs rely on that. Beliefs rely on the feeling of knowing that it's true, and it's a feeling that it's true.
And Mark, don't you think that – and it's subjective.
Oh, yeah.
This is where things get really confusing. You can have a highly delusional person who says, you know, I am Napoleon Bonaparte. That is a belief that is, for them, true. Now,
the facts may be
different, but for that's true. So that's tricky, too, when you see the subjectivity of belief.
Exactly. Now, you're absolutely right. Beliefs are purely subjective because they're based on the emotion of the individual that has the belief. Now, it happens that our social culture echoes a lot of it. So therefore, you know, we can get into a tribe because we share that belief. We share that outlook. There is a kind of a rare syndrome in psychiatry where the feeling of belief is lost. And that's called Capgras syndrome, C-A-P-G-R-A-S. It's relatively rare. It happens sometimes with schizophrenics, and it happens sometimes with people with brain injuries. What that is manifested by, the person all of a sudden doesn't recognize the people in their life as their wife, their father, their mother. They say, yeah, it kind of looks like them, but it's not them. That's an imposter. I know that's not true. And they'll their behavior will follow that belief. They'll avoid the person. They no longer can be close to them. And really what they lost from some a brain mechanism going haywire is this feeling of belief. So it's a real thing. And the feeling of belief is what drives our belief formation. It's what drives our unreasonable sometimes attachment to the beliefs. And keeps them alive, keeps them going. And we're seeing that played out in spades. These people, for instance, that Jonathan was mentioning about protesting mask wearing, mm-hmm. that it's too it's too much infringement upon them. They feel that they know that it's a bad thing to do. Wear mask. They just feel that. And that trumps anything logical you can place in front of them. They won't adopt it. They'll twist it and go on with another.
We're talking about the psychology of belief. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the psychology of belief with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And what about traditions? We're entering the holiday season and making some decisions that are not easy, and I know this is something you've been talking a lot about with your clients.
Yeah, and I think we can even segue from the belief discussion to this, because we have a belief in traditions throughout our culture. We have holidays, we have, you know, the Christmas and events that we move towards because they solidify our connections. They solidify our histories with others. And this year, tragically, it's really being suggested strongly that we do not meet in the way we've met for all the decades prior to this. And it's heartbreaking. And I've talked to many families who find themselves exceptional, you know. Every family's like, well, our family's in our pod, and even though they're flying in from, you know, Michigan and Florida, but they're all really good, safe people. And I, you know, you can't blame anybody for this, because I think it's almost like that we've gotten to the place with the pandemic where we're so desperate for connection, for warmth, for tradition, because so much of what we've come to know and believe has been upended. And what I'm also hearing is that, again, we talked a couple of sessions ago about the grief process. I really hear people grieving deeply the pain of not being able to be with their loved ones, be it the grown children and family, and making very hard decisions. In my support groups, that's all we talked about was this is a really hard thing. There's nothing natural about this, nothing easy about this. And we've got to say to the people we hold most dear, this year, I don't want you coming.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And because the risk is far too high. And of course, because we're all tender people, we're like, you know, that hurts. You don't want me, even though it might be a tremendously bad idea. This again, gets down to a belief system of, well, families together, families will always support each other. Well, always, who do you turn to? You turn to your families in times of crisis. Even that is being challenged.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, well, yeah, so it's very painful, but In my discussions with others, people are adapting to some degree and coming up with other ideas. They're not loving it, but they're doing it, such as One family is not going to meet for Thanksgiving meal, but they're going to meet to take a walk where they can be together. Another family is doing a picnic outside. And one gal said, she was very funny. She said, you know, all that traditional stuff, I love the COVID because I don't have to bake one more turkey for the last 45 years, and all the fighting about when are we going to watch the football game and when are we going to eat and when are we. So she was very funny. She broke the ice about that. That there sometimes we hold mythology around our holidays too.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I encourage people to have group Zooms, which. Many people find surprisingly satisfying, not to say that it can replace actually having everybody around the table, which, of course, as Anne points out, in some cases it's a blessing not to have that happen. But over the past several months, I've participated in family Zooms and in friend Zooms with people who are as far away as Vancouver or Miami. So these are people who, of course, it's not feasible to take a nice walk that's socially distanced because these are situations where you'd have to get on a plane to come and join the gathering. But, you know, if you can have a family Zoom with 4, 5, 6, 8, 12, whatever number of people on the screen, again, it's if you haven't tried it, it sounds maybe like a lot of BS, but you can joke around, you can share stories, you can have some fun. It's the closest that I have seen for myself and for quite a few people I know to being able to really connect with those who matter.
Right. Yeah, this is that's a very good way of negotiating the battle between logic and your feelings. It's an in-between way of compromise to see others, be with others, but not insured against passing on a deadly virus. So
I'm going to make one suggestion to anybody that does Zoom events: have a master of ceremonies or somebody that's in the lead that says, "Well, you know," and I'm telling you from I did my birthday on Zoom, and I just on the day of my birthday I said, "This is really weird. You guys, I don't know if anyone would want to do this, but I'd like to celebrate my birthday." And 15 people showed up, and I was the master of ceremonies because I thought, you don't want just 15 random people that don't know each other just staring at each other and saying happy birthday. So I kind of had even a little agenda and everything, which was, you know, it went away within a matter of minutes. But it was really fun. Everyone loved it because they met new people and there was a theme. But I have a master of ceremonies or somebody that holds it together so everyone's just not either all silent or all talking on top of each other.
Right. That's a good suggestion. Yeah. No. So we find ourselves in an uncomfortable time. And you know, as you're mentioning, Zooms, and there are some people who live alone, and of course the holidays. I had someone yesterday say, you know what, I'm okay with Thanksgiving, but Christmas alone, the thought of that just was really, really hard for her. And you know, like, and Zoom, she's like, I don't want to do another Zoom. She Zooms all the time. She's like, I don't want to do another Zoom. So we're all in an uncomfortable time, whether we're living alone or not. So how do we accept that and get through it?
Well, one option for many people who are looking forward or not looking forward to Christmas is converting to Judaism.
Very good, Jonathan.
That's absolutely right. Sometimes rabbis choose an awful lot. I mean, charge an awful lot for that process.
Can you do temporary?
That's an option.
Like conversion for a week?
Absolutely, I will offer myself to bless that.
Right, let's joining another tribe then.
Yeah, right, let's talk to Stephanie, who's giving us a call from Provincetown. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. Is it okay if my speakerphone is on or not?
You sound fine. Go right ahead.
Okay. I just read an article this morning about how they should abolish weeding out STEM classes for college students. And it turns out that it depends on, and this is relevant, it depends on what the person's social dynamics are. So people that don't fall into the most privileged group that has all kinds of good social connections on campus in a college tend to fail in these science classes and get weeded out and don't go into like the geosciences, which have a very bad track record, according to this New York Times article. So they did an experiment where at the beginning of the semester, students were in two groups, and one had to just sit down for 20 minutes and answer a bunch of questions about just a series of questions. And I'm trying to, I have that here on my phone, but merely doing this 20-minute writing exercise that made them realize that they could connect with others made those students succeed compared to the control group that answered a different type of set of questions. And that sort of relates to what one of your people just said about the, you know, the idea of, you know, the feeling of knowing. It can be an instantaneous thing. It's so interesting how change can be instantaneous and yet affect you over time. So I'm just trying to say things that would point out that how we feel about getting together at Thanksgiving can be shifted. And the fact that the news media are all have this drumbeat of how we're all so tragically separated, you know, plenty of people I know are enjoying aspects of the pandemic.
Yeah,
don't really mind it that much, you know.
Right. And, yeah, Stephanie, thank you for the phone call. We're up against the clock, but that's a good point. And sort of you touched on that. There are, you know, some people who will be are relishing the fact that they don't have to be with groups of people, right? But I think probably a bigger majority are saddened by that news.
Well, I think people are strategizing, though, Mindy, from what I can tell, because it's such a reality. And if they're affiliated with any church or group or neighbor up the road, most people are, because they recognize what's ahead, are strategizing. They're going through all the emotions of fear and loss and dread the pain around this. But it's interesting that, you know, and I'll hear that, and then next week I'll talk to somebody and they'll say something like, oh, I heard from a neighbor and we're going to do such and such. Mm-hmm. Maybe we are looking out for each other a little better than we used to because we're all in this boat. I hope so. I'm hearing that a little bit, that, you know, we're paying attention to those who might be alone. I certainly hope, as I say that if you know and everybody out there, if you know of someone that's going to be alone or you perceive they're going to be alone, you call them up and you don't have to do a big thing, but let them know that they're being thought of and let them know that they're cared for.
Yeah.
And let's spread the word on that.
A phone conversation can go a long way. All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, and social worker Ann Gagan, as always, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next month.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.